Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello, and thank you for joining me on the English program. I'm Linda Bordoni, and here's a taste of what we'll be talking about today. Pope Benedict XVI welcomes the coming into effect of the Convention on the Prohibition of Cluster Bombs. An anthropologist explains the effects of climate change on indigenous peoples and consequently on the rest of humanity. And Benedictine Abbot Timothy Wright brings us the second part of his talk on the prophet Elijah. Benedict XVI has welcomed with great satisfaction the fact that the Convention on the Prohibition of Cluster Bombs went into effect on Sunday. Speaking on Sunday to those gathered to recite the Angelus prayer with him in Castel Gandolfo, the Pope also drew attention to the many victims who have suffered and continue to suffer physical and moral damage, including death, from what the Pope called the insidious ordinance whose presence on the ground often hinders the resumption of the daily normal activities of whole communities. Charles Collins has this report.
Pope Benedict on Sunday said he welcomed with great satisfaction the fact the Convention on the Prohibition of Cluster Bombs went into effect on Sunday. He called it an encouraging sign of the world's capacity to make progress on disarmament and international human rights. He also drew attention to the many victims who have suffered and continue to suffer physical and moral damage, including death, from what the Holy Father called the insidious ordinance, whose presence on the ground often hinders the resumption of the daily normal activities of whole communities. He was speaking after his Angelus address from Castel Gandolfo. Before the Marian prayer, the Pope mentioned some of the saints whose feast days occur around this time: St. Ignatius of Loyola, the Jesuit founder; St. Alphonsus Maria de Liguori, the founder of the Redemptorists; St. Eusebius, the first bishop of Piedmont; and St. John Vianney, the cure of Ars. He said a common commitment to these saints was to save souls and serve the Church with their gifts, helping to renew and enrich her. He also spoke about the day's gospel reading.
In the gospel of today's Mass, our Lord teaches us to store up treasure for ourselves, not on the earth, but in heaven. By God's grace, then, let us seek to grow in faith and good works.
The Holy Father will be coming to the Vatican on Wednesday to resume his weekly general audiences after having taken a break for his summer vacation. I'm Charles Collins.
Thanks there to Charles Collins for that report. Indigenous peoples are a significant and important portion of humanity. Their heritage, their ways of life, their stewardship of this planet, and their cosmological insights are an invaluable treasure house for us all. More than anyone, indigenous peoples depend upon the natural environment. Their rich and detailed traditional knowledge reflects and embodies a cultural and spiritual relationship with the land, ocean, and wildlife. However, human activity is changing the world's climate and altering the natural environment in which indigenous peoples are so closely attached and onto which they so heavily rely. In a very real sense, therefore, indigenous peoples are on the front lines of climate change. They observe climate and environmental changes firsthand and use traditional knowledge and survival skills to adapt to these changes as they occur. And reflecting their position as stewards of the environment and drawing upon their old-age traditional knowledge, indigenous peoples were in fact among the first groups to call upon national governments and transnational corporations and civil society to do more to protect the Earth and human society from climate change. In fact, according to Pablo Ezaguirre, an anthropologist who works at the International Agricultural Research Center, Bioversity International, Indigenous peoples must be integrated into discussions of climate change and policy formation for the good of us all.
The people living at the margins, the people, for example, living around the polar regions, they had been noticing climate change for the last 40 years. The decrease in the ice, the new patterns of migration of animals, you know, the reindeer. They had been noticing the thawing that had been taking place earlier and earlier every year. But nobody was listening to these people, even though they would have been providing very detailed information. The same with the people living in mountains or desert margins about the what was happening to the increasing unpredictability of climate events. So my interest now is not simply to find technological solutions, but also to find solutions where these people living at the margins can be part of the solution, and that the importance of keeping these ways of life. I like to think of these communities as early warning systems, but we didn't listen, I don't think. So I think we need to establish a dialogue where scientists and these traditional communities who have long-term knowledge can begin to share information, because right now the patterns of climate change have become so severe that even the survival of these people in the circumpolar regions, for example, or at the margins of rainforests or in deserts, is at risk.
Actually, speaking to Pablo, I soon realized he had some extremely interesting things to say. "Let's take a step back," I said. "Why don't you start by explaining exactly what it is that you do?"
As an anthropologist, I work on how people use plants, how people use their environments and their particular adaptations to those environments. So I work, for example, with indigenous groups in high mountain areas or in tropical rainforests or at desert margins. In all of these environments, which appear quite difficult to survive in, and yet people have lived in these environments for thousands of years and in many cases have maintained them in a fairly productive way, which we're seeing increasing strains and difficulties in managing these environments as the world becomes more crowded and as our knowledge about how to use our natural resources is increasingly eroded.
So you're trying to protect the ancient knowledge of these people who know how to use the diversity of their regions?
Yeah, it's a lot of this knowledge is something that's been acquired over time, over several generations. Specific knowledge about different types of plants, those that are adapted to soils, either to grow with very little rainfall. And this knowledge is, in fact, quite ancient. But I think one of the things that we don't realize is that people living in these environments have to be very flexible and very innovative as well, so that there's a lot of this exchange of information and plants in particular that has taken place. And people take new information, take new plants, and adapt them to these new and difficult environments in ways that we might not have imagined. It's very difficult, for example, to explain to someone in southern Italy, for example, that tomatoes are not indigenous to Italy, but in fact they did take tomatoes, which are originally from the New World, were domesticated by the native peoples of the Americas, and tomatoes were taken to southern Italy, and they actually acquired new traits and characteristics that are important worldwide. And similarly, other plants like barley has come to the Americas and has been adapted there. So it's not just we have to, as our starting point, protect that traditional knowledge, but also you see it as a way of adapting to new circumstances and to including new opportunities.
Pablo explained that the exchange of information, together with a profound respect for biodiversity, yields precious indications in the fight against hunger and poverty.
Why is diversity so important globally?
Precisely because the world is so varied and so different, and it's changing so quickly. Some of these changes with climate change, for example, are not really ones we would like to see. They're a result of several hundred years now, the last, say, 150 years, of a real lack of concern for the fundamental processes in nature and in the world about adaptation and the use of soil, the use of water, even what we've done to the air. So given that these changes are taking place much more rapidly than we would have considered, and in ways that we can't predict, having some diversity in our crops is very important for adapting to these future changes. Because if the world is becoming drier, where are we going to find those crops that are adapted to low rainfall? If growing seasons are going to be shorter or longer, or right now we're seeing, for example, spring is coming a month earlier than it used to. There are some varieties that mature early, some varieties of plants that mature late. And a lot of these are being, I guess, the custodians of some of these plants are these traditional societies living in environments that are marginal or that were, you know, somewhat inaccessible. So we really need to connect with these people and their knowledge and find ways to support their ways of life in these areas.
I asked Pablo to give me a few examples of how climate change has had an impact on his work.
For example, we work on a lot of the high mountain areas, which were marginal to agriculture. And for example, in those areas, which have always been difficult, climate change has aggravated some of the problems of low rainfall, for example. Now, these areas, which used to rely on snowmelt for water to irrigate the crops, as these glaciers in the high mountains are being, well, they're melting away, so that this rainwater is no longer available. So people are having to shift their agricultural practices, or a lot of the things that they used to do, moving animals from the low areas to the high areas in the summer. These patterns are being changed dramatically by climate change as the seasons become shorter and shorter. And what's happening in many cases is people are losing some of their options. If you can no longer move animals to the high mountains when the grass begins to dry out on the lowlands, that really limits your possibility to keep as many animals. And these were often the insurance that they had in times of hunger and scarcity. So there's that in some of the rainforest regions, for example. As the rainforest shrinks, some of the access to many of the plants that they used as medicines, that people might have used as medicines, or the gathering of fruits, becomes more and more difficult, so that their health is often put at risk because they don't have access to modern health facilities. So the forest was really an area where they relied upon for their medicines and their well-being. A lot of the animals that they hunted, many of these are no longer available. So the drying out of forests, the shortening of growing seasons, is affecting in a disproportionate way the poor around the world. I think the more developed societies have ways of coping. But for the poor, the more you restrict in their environment, the less options that they have.
Are our governments concerned, and are they doing anything to help these people?
Well, there is a growing concern from the International Panel on Climate Change, for example. But one of the things that I'm particularly interested in is to see that some of this traditional knowledge of the people living in these difficult areas is brought into this discussion. Because it's been a scientific debate in the main, and surely some countries are making particularly the richer countries, are making some precautions, for example, through their gene banks, developing new varieties through genetic engineering that will be drought resistant. My interest now is not simply to find technological solutions, but also to find solutions where these people living at the margins can be part of the solution, and that the importance of keeping these ways of life, because they were, in a sense, I like to think of these communities as early warning systems. They were living at the margins, you know, so they saw the spread of deserts well before, in many ways, the global scientific community was paying attention. They saw the melting of the polar ice caps. They were among the first to call our attention to it. But we didn't listen, I don't think. So I think we need to establish a dialogue where scientists in these traditional communities who have long-term knowledge can begin to share information, because right now the patterns of climate change have become so severe that even the survival of these people in the circumpolar regions, for example, or at the margins of rainforests or in deserts, is at risk. So they also need the help of scientists to be able to survive in those areas. And they have a cultural right to live where they do. This is where their culture is developed, and their particular way of life, I think, merits our respect and support.
In a way, you're giving voice to these people. Is anyone else doing that?
Yes, they do have a voice in certain organizations, such as the United Nations. They do have a voice in some negotiations, for example, on intellectual property rights and their particular rights to their traditional knowledge systems. But it's what I'd like to see much more than just recognizing their rights, is recognizing the central role that they play for all of us as a planet, as a community of people that have to survive in a world that's increasingly damaged by our own activities, that they need to be a voice in the scientific debates as well, that their information, their knowledge was ignored for so long. You know, their areas are considered marginal to agriculture or marginal to development, but in fact, they're there for a reason, because these environments provide, you know, rich ways of life that we've never considered. So I don't want to separate their way of life from the scientific knowledge and information that they can contribute, nor do I want science to ignore the plights of these people and say, well, the world is changing, it's getting hotter and it's getting drier, so people shouldn't live near the deserts and we shouldn't be living in high mountains. One of the unique attributes of our species is that we do occupy a lot of different environments. We're not constrained by biology to live because we have culture, because we have, you know, and even in many cases, the particular spiritual beliefs of people living in mountains. The mountains to them are sacred places, certain mountains, certain parts of the forest are sacred places. And these have been important ways, I think, as a humanity has defined its way in the world. And I'd hate to see that diversity be diminished. At the same time, we're also diminishing the resources of our planet. I think the two have to go together.
Pablo, very clearly, is passionate about his work and nurtures a deep respect for the peoples he has learned to know. I asked him whether he's optimistic about things to come.
Well, I'm optimistic every time I work in these areas and I see the creativity of these people. You go to these areas and these communities, it's not a pessimistic point of view. They rely on a lot of their own creativity and their culture, and you still see these kinds of, you know, the inevitable optimism, I think, of the human species. And so if we look more to them and listen to them, I don't think we get such a pessimistic view, because people are incredibly able to adapt and they have a remarkable ability to be creative and find creative solutions. It's when we don't listen to people and we don't listen to their experiences that we can develop a very negative and insular and closed and negative view of our situation. And I'd like to just open this dialogue, and I'm hopeful that this dialogue is beginning and that it's not just a question of helping these people as a type of charity, because I don't think that's what they want. They want to be heard and recognized for the creativity and the strength of their cultures and their particular systems of knowledge.
And now my friend, Benedictine abbot Timothy Wright, brings us the second part of his talk on the prophet Elijah, the story of a powerful king determined to get his own way. Last week, Elijah, on God's command, first proclaimed drought, then, always on God's orders, lived in a cave in total obedience to the Creator. In the next phase, having accepted that his life is in the hands of God, he meets up with a woman and works the miracle of providing food. Thanks, Father Timothy points out, to the innate sense of hospitality of the woman herself. And the second point of the reflection, he says, is that if we really want to communicate God to each other, we have to be open to each other, and we have to learn that other people are important, and that hospitality is a way of recognizing God in our neighbour, whoever that neighbour is. But now Elijah's story continues to unfold dramatically.
And then, having eaten the food, the next disaster happens in the household. The son dies. And the widow is beside herself with remorse and says to Elijah, "What have I done? And Elijah says, you know what you've done. And the woman then realizes that she had been a sinner. And that is our third step of our retreat, of our own little desert, is to recognize that some of the negative things in our lives emerge out of our own weakness, of our selfishness. And very often, we can cloak all that with moral righteousness. And many of us, I'm certainly guilty of moral righteousness. When in fact, the moral truth is the generous open-heartedness of someone who has nothing and still wants to share. And yet, in that open-heartedness from the past, there is a guilt. And the death of the son is a reminder of the guilt. I'm not saying the death of the son was caused by the guilt. That's not the point. But it brought to life a deep sense of guilt, hiding an even deeper sense of faith. And Elijah moves into the position of healing the son, raising the son to life, and removing that sense of guilt, offering the love of God, which is forgiveness and mercy, to this poor woman who's been struggling for years with this covered sense of guilt, unworthiness. And how many people there are in the world who suffer this sense of oppressive guilt, often, sadly, laid on them by others who should know better. And so the child lives, the woman recovers her sense of faith and the ability to love. And then Elijah is then swept away to the top of Mount Carmel in order to bring home to that king that the religious structures that he had bought into were phony. That it was Elijah who was God's prophet. And so there took this public contest between the prophets of the Baals and Elijah on the top of this mountain. And the contest was simple. They gathered all the people, they put the prophets there, and each of them was going to offer a sacrifice. And the prophets of the Baals laid out their sacrifice, chanted their prayers, implored their God. And the intention was, come God, burn our sacrifice. But nothing happened. And then, having accepted that nothing happened, and confident that Elijah would have the same fate, Ahab turned to Elijah and said, right, your go now. So Elijah prepared his sacrifice, just him, his sacrifice. And to make it even more obvious, he'd poured water all over the sacrifice. And he then prayed, burnt the offering, and it huge, towering flame. Truth and falsehood, our fourth element of our retreat. The truth of the God who creates, who continues to love and offers a future. The falsehood, represented by the 400 prophets, speaking with eloquent tongues, convincing millions of people in that area, able to produce subtle answers and ask difficult questions. And yet, at the moment of challenge, failed. Ahab was quick to remove the prophets of the Baals, condemned because they were false. But it is a challenge that our reflection in our retreat allows us to ponder truth and falsehood. The truth that God creates and our lives are dependent. The truth that God guides us. The truth that God is present in hospitality. The truth that God forgives our sins to renew our life, strengthen our love. The truth that God is the one that works the wonders. And it was precisely at that moment, after the contest with the prophets of Baal, that Elijah then called on the heavens and the rains came. But that's not the end of the story. Jezebel, the wife of Ahab, had now got it in for Elijah. All her religion had been destroyed. Her husband was now in a situation where he totally reliant on this wandering preacher who didn't seem to be able to be stable anywhere. And Elijah hears that Jezebel is determined to kill him. So off he goes to the desert, making his way eventually to Mount Sinai. And he climbs Mount Sinai. And there is the final point of our retreat. There he has the intimacy of a sense of the presence of God. Not a vision, but a sense. Not in a wind or an earthquake, but in stillness. And it is that moment of vision. It can be a moment of peace, of tranquility. It can be a moment of daring courage. It can be a moment of deep suffering tinged with a promise of life. Whatever that moment is, it's the touch of God. And that is what culminates a retreat, as it culminated Elijah's life. And our own need for such a moment to reflect on the prophet of Elijah as a model for our own life is an agenda which a few days away on retreat, either on own or with deep friends, with silence, with reflection, with hope, with honesty, but in the end, most important of all, the love that is the presence of God, affirming each of us where we are at, saying, yes, I love you more than you love me.
That was Benedictine Abbot Timothy Wright. That's all from the English feature programme today, but we will be back at this same time tomorrow, so join us then. You can also listen to our programmes on the internet at www.vaticanradio.org. You're listening to Vatican Radio's English programme. Laudetur Jesus Christus.